Welcome back to the Training Bible Podcast. I'm your host, Coach Dave Schell, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Olympic mountain biker Leah Davison. Leah, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm psyched we can make it happen.
Yeah, me too. I am. Before we started recording, I told you I just watched one of your TED Talks, and it just got me even more excited to talk to you. And I think we have so much to talk about today that we probably won't get to all of it, but it's going to be a great conversation.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So first off, for people who may not be familiar with you, can you just give us a brief introduction of yourself, and then we'll kind of dig into your history?
Yeah, my name is Leah Davison. I'm hailing from southern Vermont right now, where I live with my wife, Fraser Blair. I've been mountain bike racing since 2001. So I had a 20-year plus long career of elite mountain bike racing, racing at the World Cup level, World Championships, and I qualified and competed at two Olympic Games, London 2012 and Rio 2016 Olympic Games, where I came in 11th and 7th in Rio. I also have two mountain bike world championship medals to my name, so I'm very proud of all those accomplishments. And at some point during that career in 2007, actually, I started Little Bellas, which is a mentoring on mountain bikes program with my sister, Sabra Davison, who is now the executive director, and another woman, Angela Irvine. And so that started in Vermont, and now we are nationwide, actually. So very exciting.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how did you get into mountain biking? Because you started off as a skier, correct?
Yeah, I was actually a downhill ski racer and a runner growing up. So, which is a very interesting combination. So downhill skiing was the main focus, although my parents threw us into every sport imaginable growing up in Vermont, because my mom came from a pre-Title IX era. And she's a very competitive woman, very capable, and she had no like athletics to play. So other than cheerleading. So she did a very good job at that. And took those skills to cheer me on throughout my career, and kind of got a reputation for herself. But so she threw us into a lot of sports. Downhill skiing really stuck throughout high school. And then in high school, I also got into longer distance running. I actually started track and field thinking I was a sprinter, which is wild. Because I was a downhill ski racer, that's like a 30-second effort, right?
Yeah.
And luckily, one of my friends was like, hey, why don't you come try running distance? And I was like, this is so hard. I'm like so sore. And I was good at it. You know, I started running the 1500, 3000. And that's kind of where my endurance career began. Because I had a very good female coach in high school for cross country running. And I had, I was teammates with the high school national champion, Aaron Sullivan. So that's really where I learned how to suffer. And my junior year in high school, a friend, at the time, Dan Dombrowski, he was like, hey, why don't you stop running in circles on the track and like try this mountain biking thing? And we actually had a mountain bike club at our high school at the time. So it was like love at first sight, honestly. It combined the endurance from running, and then also kind of the skills were very similar to downhill skiing. So you need to look ahead. The body positions were kind of similar, picking a line. So I fell in love immediately with the sport.
And so did you start with the mountain biking? Was it immediately competitive, or was it more just doing it for fun? How did that kind of transpire?
Oh, it was immediately competitive.
Yeah.
Immediately. I'm a very competitive person. Yeah, we started racing our local race series, Catamount Outdoor Center. It's actually the longest weekly race series in the country.
Oh, awesome.
Wednesday night. Yeah. And so you can do one lap, two lap, three lap, four lap. And I started out with two, That I believe that was like my first race. And then we started going around to races in the summer, just local races, and just loving it. And then year two, I believe it was so long ago, we did Mount Snow. So at that time, Mount Snow, Vermont was a Norba National, which is now the National Series, now US Cup. And that went well. And I also went to Snowshoe, West Virginia, and that was a Norba National. And I won Snowshoe.
Okay.
And a USA Cycling official came up to me and said, "Hey, you won this junior race. You've qualified for Worlds." And I was like, there's a Worlds for this? Like, then my entire world like kind of opened up. And in that moment, I realized like, oh, this, you can make a living doing this. This is like a professional athletic career. And there's an Olympics for mountain biking. Game on. I'm doing this. Because I always had Olympic aspirations and in ski racing. And it wasn't quite jiving. So I was like, I'm doing this. And I was like laser focused on that goal from that moment.
And so how did that kind of progress over time? Like, were you immediately competitive, or was it kind of a little bit of a rough awakening when you, or rude awakening when you first started racing at the level? Or when did you enlist the help of a coach?
Immediately, was that true? Like, once I qualified for Worlds, then I was like, oh, I probably should get a coach. I was on team, that was after Worlds. So, somehow I had met Andy Bishop during my time racing in Vermont, and Andy was still racing at the time, was a pro or maybe recently retired. And I was like, Andy, will you coach me leading up to World Championships? And he did. He coached me for like 3 weeks, and I had the best time. I mean, it was so awesome to be on a training plan with him. And I went to Worlds at the same time I was balancing training for running, because I got recruited to run in college. So that was kind of a disaster. And I was competitive at Junior Worlds. I came in seventh. I had the second lap was the fastest lap time. And I kind of think back to that moment because I had no idea, like no one prepared me for that moment in terms of, I didn't even know I had to be to the call-up boxes like 15 to 20 minutes before. So I didn't get a good enough warm-up.
Yeah.
So I think if I like knew, I warmed up by the time the second lap came around. So yeah, it's so funny to kind of think back about that. And I also kept that in mind when these juniors would come onto the World Championship team, and I would just like really bring them through that, the whole process of racing at the elite level, because I had no clue. I mean, I was racing with a Camelback.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you and I kind of met because you have started to coach a bit, and you, mm-hmm. you've interacted with a lot of coaches. You've had interactions with the staff at USA Cycling. And so you've seen the way a lot of coaches kind of prescribe workouts and the emphasis on power and data and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare with what you were doing with Andy and kind of what your training looked like at that time?
Yeah. I laugh because it's so different. It's so different what I did for training at the beginning. I mean, not the beginning, but like things evolved so much over 20 years. There wasn't any power meters. It was only heart rate, right? And that's how we like, that was the one metric. And then, you know, fast forward 10 years, all of a sudden power meters start to get involved and everything. Things became much more numbers focused, and Andy and I did not. You know, we luckily are the same personality type. I feel like we very much jibe in terms of, I don't know if you're familiar with Myers-Briggs. I'm an ENFP, So it's very, I'm like a feeler and I'm very intuitive. And also like a full-on extrovert, which is neither here or there in this conversation, but like, and I feel like Andy's the same. So it, I would always go by feel a lot of the time. And Andy would also say things like, I feel like you need this kind of effort, you know, like, and kind of go by his intuition in terms of, he knows the, what it takes to race at a high level. He raced in several tours, Tour de France. He, you know, then switched over to the mountain bike and raced on Subaru Gary Fisher, raced World Cup. So he knows what it takes. So I had a very, I have a very different approach than I feel like a lot of the coaches and athletes in today's age.
Yeah, and so now you work with a couple of young athletes, and you also mentored, like you said, you were mentoring some of the juniors that would come up, and then on the Olympic team, you were also working together and kind of mentoring people as they're coming up. What have you seen as data's become more prevalent and people become more focused on that? Like, how have you seen the sport change, and it, how do you think that's impacted performance or athletes' ability to perform?
I mean, everything is on a spectrum, right? Like, there's no like black and white answer. We talk a lot about this like offline when we collaborate on coaching. And I feel like it's mostly data and numbers are mostly on the side of limiting performance of athletes at the elite level. And I saw it even before I got into coaching. I mean, I would see these riders come up in the U23 category, and they would race. I would tell all of them, all, every single one, do not race with your computer on. Like, do not, or at least tape over the screen or put it in your back pocket, because you look down and mainly it's a distraction. Like, very much so in mountain biking, you need to be in the moment.
Right.
And 99% of the time, you look down and it's another reason that your brain's going to tell you, you should slow down. You're literally going to die. I mean, if I looked at my heart rate or power in a World Cup, I'd be like, there is no way I can continue this.
Right.
I mean, there's enough negative self-talk that you're dealing with when you're racing so on the limit that you don't need another information point telling you you can't do it.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I coach a couple of ladies, and that's a conversation we've had recently. One just stopped wearing a heart rate strap. The other stopped displaying it when she races. And it's that same thing. It's just, like you said, it's, you're sitting there battling these voices that are telling you to stop and trying to give you reasons to stop. And then all of a sudden you have this objective metric that's also like adding fuel to that fire. And so, yeah, I experienced it in my own racing as well, where this is an aside, but I had a PT, a physical therapist, that was a pretty great athlete. And one time I went in and I was injured for something, and he was asking me, I was telling him about something. And he's like, how old are you? And at the time, I think I was like 28 or 30. And I'm like, 30. And he's like, it should always hurt, dude. And I'm like,
what?
He was talking about the effort, right? When you're in a race. And I'm like, you know, and I'm like, okay. And so I kind of took that to heart. And so then I stopped racing with data. You know, I stopped racing with the GPS, and I started racing with like a wristwatch just so I had time. And all of a sudden I took like 5 minutes off my 5K or my 10K, you know. It's just like,
wow.
It was just like this breakthrough. And it's something I've definitely seen with athletes, where that's so much of an aspect of performance, is like really pushing beyond what your body's telling you can do, or your brain's telling you what you can do, you know. And so anytime you can limit those outside voices is going to be helpful, I think.
Totally. It's like simplifying it, right? And my dad said something. My dad used to run cross country as well. And when I was running, you know, we were having a conversation, and he said, Leah, same thing. It's always going to hurt, but you'll just go faster.
Right.
Like, once you start to get in better shape. And I've like really carried that with me. And another thing that I picked up on through working with these athletes is when you get at the elite level, right, like the pointy end of the spear, sometimes you can get like perfectionists, and it's kind of like blowing the doors off that, like everything needs to be perfect in order to have a good performance, because it's never going to be perfect.
Right.
And there's like, I don't know, I can probably count on my hand, one hand, the amount of days that I felt incredible racing.
Right.
And I raced for 20 years World Cups, and it, like 2016 World Champs, I felt amazing. And I was like, and I came in second from a 20th start position. So that was one day.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, none of the other days fell on the two Olympic days out of all that time, but like I got some good ones. And so it's like, what do you do when the majority of the time things don't go right? And you show up with like, meh, legs. Like, how do you respond to that? Because that's going to be the situation for the majority of the time.
Yeah. So that brings up a good point. And I think this is something you kind of emphasize, and it's something you've experienced, like the importance of mental resilience.
And yeah,
it's, you know, I talk to my athletes about this, and it's just like, shit's going to happen, especially as people are racing longer and longer. So people that are doing these gravel races or doing Leadville or something, it's like, you're out there for such a long time, like nutrition issues, mechanical issues, like dark, like things are going to happen. And so how do you work on that, both with yourself when you're mentoring these other athletes? Like what are some of the things you do to help cultivate that?
Yeah. Well, first, a big thing I focus on is the effort, because you can't control the results. You can't control how anyone else shows up to the start line. You can only control you and the effort that you give. That's it. And so always my focus is, did you put out your best effort from start to finish? Like, yeah, did you do your best? And for them to really understand that, like, that is hard.
Yeah.
Like, if you have done your best, you are at the finish line and you can't even stand up. You know, you are barely crossing that finish line, and it's vulnerable. It's like way easier, especially since a lot of these athletes are living their journey on Instagram in front of everybody, you know? Geez. And it's like way easier to have like that excuse ready, you know, like, oh, I didn't feel good today. Oh, I didn't have, you know, like name all the excuses that you've heard, right? And
yes,
it's like, yeah, but did you give your best effort? Like, so, I almost don't care how you felt. Did you do your the best that you could?
So, one, I love that. I 100% agree with that. And I'm sure you know Steve Prefontaine. And
yeah,
one of my favorite quotes, and something that I've probably mentioned before on the podcast, is to give anything less than your best is to sacrifice a gift. And for me, that was like in races, is like when I was having, I would just like check in, like, is this your best? And if I could honestly say, yep, this is what I have right now, then cool, you know. But if I can't, like, if I'm like, no, I'm feeling sorry for myself, I can push a little bit harder here or whatever, like, that's all you can do, right? Like all you can do is your best. And so I love that. But I want to talk a little bit more about Instagram and Strava and stuff like that.
Yes.
So I maybe this might get me in trouble, but I very much feel that there's this culture now, like maybe over the last several years, 3 to 5 years, where it's almost more about like there's honor in failing or something, like there's almost more to that, like people like having this story and like being able to like, you know, talk about how everything went wrong and all these things, like,
oh yeah,
that's almost being celebrated now, you know,
because that's under the guise of vulnerability, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
So I guess, yeah. What do you, like, I mean, do you see the same thing or, and how do you feel about that? You kind of talked about like having your excuses at the ready on Instagram.
Yeah, it's, you know, Instagram is so tough. And I'm glad that I grew up racing in a pre-Instagram world, because it didn't matter how many followers that I had or how often I post or, you know, did the algorithm screw me over or not, you know, and you have to post on this day. It's a lot. I mean, it's a lot of time and energy and distraction that goes into it. And all of these athletes have to not only be an athlete, you have to be your own marketing manager and content creator. I mean, really. And so it's a lot of pressure. And, you know, sometimes you get to some weeks and you're like, well, I don't know what I'm going to post. And then also there's an expectation, I think, like you were saying, to explain yourself, right? Like after a tough race. And I mean, in some ways, it's like a, you know, that's one big long excuse.
Yeah.
Like a little bit. I mean, I got a flan and blah, blah, blah. And then I got taken out. It's like, yeah, this happens like most races.
Right.
Like you dab or you get taken out or, you know, it doesn't go perfectly. And you know, that's a little bit more interesting to read than like, well, I gave it my best.
Right. Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. It's the drama, right?
Yeah. So I think there's like a little bit both, forces at play, and it's not easy to like kind of walk that line and try to figure out what to say. Cause you're like building this like public persona, right? And there's like a lot of pressure on Instagram and like, am I putting out the right image, you know, like, or the image that these athletes want to put out. So you get a lot of like, it's all glory. Like here I am in Italy and you're not seeing like the tiny hotel room or extreme jet lag rides where I almost like fell asleep on my bike. And then like, you know, so it's I think it's a toxic narrative when it comes to that, because it's like sometimes it can glorify the professional athlete lifestyle and like what it actually takes to race at that elite level.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about something else that I think is related. And you brought this up to me and I didn't know there was an actual name for it. But the idea of this victim versus player mindset.
Oh, yeah.
And so where does that come from? And explain that to us.
Yeah, this is a concept that one of my therapists or like life coaches, I work with like a career coach, life coach. I just bring in all the coaches all the time. The more coaches, the better.
Smart.
This is a concept that, so the victim stance, if you're taking a victim stance, it is all of these things are happening to me, right? Like, this is not my fault. This is this, all these other person, these people's fault, or it was the weather's fault, or all of this is happening to me. I have no control over it. And like, that's really the excuse factory too, like in the victim stance. And then player's stance is like standing like strong on your own two feet and making decisions intentionally that you own, that you take ownership for, and accountability. It's about accountability. So it's like, well, I didn't check the weather today for today's training. And so I went out there and I got stuck in a thunderstorm in the middle of the workout and I couldn't finish it. That happened to me, right? But if I'm taking a player's stance, I go, well, I messed up.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't check the weather. I didn't make a good decision. And then I didn't finish the workout, which is like my one job if you're a professional athlete. And so taking the player stance is empowering because you have control over your own destiny and you're making good decisions. And it's also about, it goes hand in hand with the growth mindset, which is something that I really try to cultivate in my work with my athletes, which is, what did you learn from that experience today, right? Like, what's the takeaway? Because like the two questions I ask them after the race is, how'd it go? Well, it's not two. How'd it go? Did you give your best effort? Did you fight to the finish? And what did you learn?
Yeah.
You know, so it like makes it's all about improving and learning and growing. That's what like getting the most out of yourself is.
I love that. And I'm going to steal that. So currently, like I ask, like, what are three things that went well and three things that could have went better? But I like framing it. What are three things you learned?
And yes,
going back to your statement that, you know, you can count on one hand the number of great days that you had.
Yeah.
And that's just it, right? Like I'm a sucker for quotes, but another one of my favorite quotes is, we never lose, we only learn. Right.
Yes.
And so like, if you're not on the top step every race, it's few and far between for most people. Right. But if you can take something and improve the next time from it, then you've still won because you've learned and become a better racer. So
exactly. And that is also why you never give up in a race, unless you have hit your head or you're really injured. That's my rule.
I laugh at it because you and I had a discussion about bailing on workouts too. And so I'm curious if you've changed your stance on that at all, or
it's so hard for me to, Dave. Like, I literally come from a career where I do not think I cut a workout short or like gave up on a workout. I mean, there are days where I was like, before the workout, I'm not feeling it, I think I'm getting sick, right? Like, that's a different thing.
Got
or
it.
Like, I am completely smoked. But like, I don't think I can do this. But like, that is very rare. And so I know I hold, like, I come from a different, it's maybe old school, you know, like, I come from an old school train of thought, which is like, yeah, I give my best every single day, whether maybe I'm like 50% doing a workout because I've come, it's the last day of a 7-day training block, right? But I'm still going to give as much as I can under the given circumstances and finish that workout because I gained a lot of confidence from that.
Yeah.
And I think it comes from the concept of like, well, I may not be the most naturally gifted, but I sure as hell can outwork everybody else.
Right.
Like, I can work harder than everybody else, and that's going to pay off.
Yeah. And I will say, like, I'll frame this a little bit differently in that you're working with different athletes than I'm working with for the most part. And
yeah,
a lot of times I'm working with people that also have a full-time job and a family. And, you know, and so we're trying to get the best quality on when we're doing a hard workout or intervals. We want it to be the highest quality possible because it's only happening a few times a week. You're working with people that this is either currently their job or they want it to be their job. And in my experience in talking to athletes at that level, like, you are a lot more cutthroat and a lot more drill sergeant a lot of times because that's what it takes, right? It's like, you either do it or you don't. Like, at that level, in order to make it, you either do it or you don't. So
exactly. Yeah. I've realized that I definitely come from a different school of thought, I think, in an approach in my coaching, because I coach that way.
Yeah.
And like, I've run into some friction because of athletes coming from different schools of thought where maybe it was like a little bit more flexible. And I was like, mind blown. Like, because this is, you know, like, I'm coming from my career and this is like the one thing that you do the workout and to the best of your ability. And so it's just a process of, for me, really learning different athletes and their approaches and kind of like bending a little bit and working with athletes are so different. like physiologically, mentally, like it, they need such different things.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. And that's why I'm like very grateful to have you in my corner, like to bounce stuff off of. I mean, for all the listeners, like I just called, I'm like, oh, thank goodness I can ask Dave this question. like on the regular, you know, because I, as I just said, I was not a numbers focused athlete.
Yeah.
And so I have athletes who are very numbers focused.
Right.
And like power and all the metrics and training peaks. Like I didn't even know what CTL meant. I figured like form probably meant my fitness and then like fatigue or whatever, that meant something. But I literally never looked at those numbers ever in training peaks.
Right. And I think people could learn something from that, right? It's like,
yes.
And that it's kind of interesting. When I worked for Training Peaks, I traveled all over the world and I would like meet with very high level coaches at the Australian Institute of Sport and at British Cycling and stuff like that. And in my experience, the higher up you go, the simpler it gets, you know?
Wow.
Like I feel like coaches who maybe have more time, like they're way more in the weeds with the data and stuff like that. But like at that level, like it's pretty simple and it really comes down to like some fundamentals, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of it is like, especially in mountain biking, it's not about the numbers.
Right.
I mean, there's such an obsession in the sport of mountain biking. Well, in the sport of cycling with power numbers and power to weight. And it needs to be this number if you have any talent. And that drives me insane because it fuels the toxic narrative of like, you have to be skinny to be fast. The lighter is better. And it's like, no, you have to be fueled to
and
be
strong,
fast.
Right.
And strong. Yep. And if you're not, you are screwing yourself. And if you're trying to drop weight for a race, you're also dropping all of that hard work and strength and fitness along with it. So you're going to arrive at that peak race not in your best form.
Yeah.
And so like there is such an obsession about numbers and it's like, actually, when it comes down to it, you're like all those women who line up on the World Cup start line. Like we are all probably pretty much the same fit, right?
Right.
Like we all, and it's like that extra 1%, which is, it could be, do you have your period?
Right.
Like, are you like 2 days before your period? I mean, I think that window is a disaster to deal with as a female athlete. That's why the women's field is so exciting to watch because at any point, hopefully, they're all getting their periods. At any point, 25% of the field could be in that not ideal window.
So that's, here's going to be another diversion, digression, I guess. So that's really interesting. And I know that it's been a big focus over the last several years, kind of training around the menstrual cycle and changing how you feel and stuff like that. And I coach a lot of female athletes and that's always been my thought. It's like, rather than like, because you can't change when the race is going to happen and stuff. So it's like you need to be prepared or like used to doing work in certain times and stuff. And it's like, yeah, sometimes you're not going to feel your best and like we can adjust things based on that. But you do your best that day, whatever that best is. And so I'm curious, like, how do you like in the latter part of your career and then now with your athletes, like how do you address that or like how do you handle that?
Yeah, this is a great question because this is what led me to coaching because, you know, last year I retired at the end of 2022 and then I was trying a bunch of different paths, which was race broadcasting, you know, announcing, commentating, live broadcasts, public speaking and coaching. And I did some coaching for the national team, but that's not like individual one-on-one coaching. And I thought, I'm never going to do that. That's like, that's a to do every day for me. And that's a disaster because I like to be free range. And I like to like go over here and then go over there and shooby-doo. And at the end of the season, you know, a woman came up to me that was part of the national team and was like, Leah, will you be my coach? And I'm like, no, but I'm going to link you up with some people who I trust or try to find some good options. And so then I went on this journey with her, and all I could find were male coaches, which, by the way, can be great.
I know.
Dave is one of
them.
That's going
to be my follow-up question. Yeah, exactly. No.
They can be. I mean, I had a male coach for my entire career.
Right.
Phenomenal. Andy's phenomenal. And, you know, she would come back from like meeting with these coaches, and I'm like, at the same time was reading this book, Good for a Girl by Lauren Fleshman, who is, this book was like a game changer for me. And she talks about the prevalence of red S, which is relative energy deficiency syndrome in female athletes. It can be in male too. And then it pretty much boils down to there's not enough female coaches. And this whole structure of sport is designed by and for men, right? So I was getting that message at the same time of going through this journey of like trying to find her another coach. And I'm like, I don't think any of these coaches are asking her if she gets her period, because it's kind of like a taboo subject. And it's super important because female athletes, that is the first red flag and canary in the coal mine for red S.
And I've even heard some coaches, I've coached some athletes, where coaches told them, maybe in college, that it's a good sign when you stop having your period. That means that you're fit enough or that you've done enough work. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So this is what we're up against.
Yeah.
This is what that book, I mean, highly recommend it, Good for a Girl, goes into. And you know, if you have females that get red S between like, you know, that college age, end of high school, that is the main time where you get all of your bone density. Mm-hmm. And to get bone density, you have to be getting your period. You have to be fueling and you have to fuel to get your period. And like you can blow up your entire career in those years if you have red S. And so there's just a lack of knowledge about it, right?
Yeah. And like you said, there's an emphasis on it too, where it's encouraged to be lighter, especially when you're biking or cycling. But yeah, it's something that I, especially with young female athletes, like I hate talking about weight. And it's like, it has to like really be important. It has to be like the most important thing before we have that conversation. But until that point, we're going to work on being strong, working on skills, working on your fitness, other things, you know? So
yes. Power numbers. I mean, there is so much. Are you fueled? Are you hydrated? Are you mentally tough? Do you have the bike handling enough to recover, you know, and not be stressed going off of these like major things. I mean, those are just five factors in mountain biking off the top of my head that tactics, race tactics, right? There's so much else out there, like other than power to weight ratio. And actually it's like, we are like lighting on fire, not in a good way, to a lot of our talent because of this like toxic narrative that you have to be light to be fast. Like, no, you're actually like going through a big detriment. So to yourself and potentially putting your whole career in jeopardy. And so like, I was like, okay, I need to coach. This is the only answer. Like I have 20 years of experience. I know what it takes to race at a high level. I don't have like the analytics and the power, and that's where I go to you, Dave. and so that's why I got into it. And I'm like, it's been awesome because it's kept my hand in the sport. And I think hopefully in a small way, like changing these narratives that exist in cycling.
Yeah. So on that note, I want to hear more about Little Bellas and why, what was the inspiration for that? And what is the mission behind it?
Yeah. So Little Bellas is a mentoring on mountain bikes program for girls. And we started it back in 2007. It actually was a senior project in college for my sister.
Oh, interesting.
And she was a women and gender studies minor. And they said, you know, she graduated and did the mission statement and everything. And they said, you know, you don't actually have to start this organization. And she's like, no, we're doing this.
Yeah, I've done all the work
now. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we saw the need for to get more girls on bikes. It's as simple as that. Yeah. I mean, there's like always an inequity in terms of female representation in cycling and in all sports. And so that was a way to almost give the gift of the bike and riding a bike and that those opportunities and what it does for a young human to more girls, because it's very much so. Mountain biking is an empowering pursuit.
Right.
You literally have to get over obstacles.
Yeah. So it's funny, and I'll link to this too, but I've got like, there's an Instagram post I did a long time ago is like mountain bike as a metaphor for life. And I think about it all the time when I'm out there, you know, just little things like that. Like sometimes it will be hard, just like drop a gear and get over it. Like, you know, find a goodwill. Like it's okay to stop sometimes and like assess your next move. And yeah. So why do you think there is this inequity with women in endurance sport? And I've seen it too when I worked at Training Peaks, and like it seems to be about a 70-30 split across sport when we're talking about coaches, cycling, just sport in general. And so why do you think it is that occurs?
Woo! That is a big question. We're definitely going over time, Dave, with that question. I mean, it's the same. I think it's for the same reason that, you know, society is structured how it is. It's like sport follows that. Like I said, sport is and athletics is designed for and by men. And so there's a lack of representation. So if you can't see it, you can't be it. That's like a big thing that I live by. That's part of the reason why we created Little Bellas. There are so many forces working against women in sport and at all levels of sport, right? I mean, Red S, we talked about this narrative about eating. The simple structure of sport and the mindset that male coaches bring to it, some male coaches, I'll qualify that, is, you know, men and women are different in terms of their development and their progression in sport. Like women, I'll just say this, men, when they go through puberty, just get stronger, faster. It's like this direct line of improvement. And so I feel like a lot of the coaches out there see the men, and since there's not a lot of research also and visibility of women in sports and coaches, then women, when they go through puberty, it's rough. I mean, they were light before, and then all of a sudden we start putting on weight, we start to put on more muscle. And it kind of like you hit a plateau and then you start going up. But a lot of negative can happen in that plateau. Eating disorders, red ass, dropping out of sport because you're frustrated. And if we're not normalizing this like kind of plateau in progression and like, man, just keep going.
Right.
Just keep going because you will improve. Like, you may not be seeing this work like as a direct correlation right now, but you're getting better. And your body's changing. And so you're like adjusting to this new body. And there's just a lot of forces like working against, I think, women in general. And then you get older and then there's the pressure to have a family, right? If you want to have a family, what are you going to do? There's not a support system in play for moms in elite level sports in a lot of places. Now, some companies, after the whole Nike scandal with Allyson Felix, like are writing pregnancy clauses into their contract. And still there's like, a lot of pressure around like, well, how am I going to do all of this? It's not even possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I started working with a women's mountain bike team or off-road team called the Dirty Mamas. And it's really built around that nice. Idea is that it is hard. Like there is this maybe unwritten expectation or unsaid expectation that when you're the mom, your job is to take care of the house and the kids and all these other things. And it's almost, you need to put aside your own aspirations to do that. And so I can see how that would be hard to, at that point, and so we're trying to change that a little bit, but I like that you're doing it earlier on with the little Bellas as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's very much early. It's the other end of the age spectrum.
Yeah.
But yeah, it starts there. I mean, it's mountain biking for me, simply put, is like when I am riding a bike, I feel powerful.
Yeah.
And when I don't get to ride a bike, I feel like a significant loss of power.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with confidence too. At least that's been my experience with it, is that when people can achieve things they didn't think they could in sport or overcome adversity, it starts to leak to other parts of life too.
Yeah.
You start to carry yourself a little prouder and taller and things like that, and you can handle things better. Yeah, I think sport's so important, and it's not just about being competitive, even though it sounds like you're pretty competitive.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, so many lessons learned, really, from a career of pursuing like the highest level of sport.
And so now you said you retired in 2022?
At the end of 2022, yeah.
And so, and you were playing with different things. You said like broadcasting, public speaking, coaching. Still haven't decided what you want to be when you grow up yet. You had mentioned before, one of the times you and I were talking, that you've taken your last Olympic experience and it wasn't necessarily a successful one or the things that you would have hoped it to be, but that's what you're traveling around talking about now. So how did that... what kind of impact did that have on you? And first tell us the experience, and then how did that impact you and how are you using that moving forward?
Yeah.
Okay. My experience wasn't ideal. I go to two Olympics. I'm on this like natural progression, right? Of, okay, I came in 11th place in my first games. I came in seventh in my second games. Like, this is it. Tokyo will be my like final shot at this Olympic medal that I've always dreamed of getting. And I felt like I came into the 2020 season like ready. I was ragingly fit, and then the pandemic happened. And I feel like for a lot of the older athletes that trying to qualify for the Olympics, that was a detriment, because it was like, oh man, we have to like keep doing this for a year, like hang on, like keep training. And the younger athletes like had an extra year to train, extra year of experience, like to build up. And I trained through the pandemic. I got an espresso machine because I need some caffeine to get through that. And then literally the first day of training for the 2021 season, the Olympic season, I was lifting in the gym and I felt like a pain in my lower back. And I had torn a disc, like a slight tear in my disc between L4 and L5. And I was like, shit.
Yeah.
Like, you just know that everything needs to go perfectly. Like, you need to have a little bit of luck to qualify for the Olympics and then obviously compete. But qualifying is like the most important part like of the journey. And I thought, it's okay. It's like October, November. I still have time. I can recover from this. I was recovering. And then I put in this major, major training block, like one of the biggest volume and intensity weeks that I've done. In December, and I was like simply carrying my bike up the stairs.
Oh, shit.
I felt it go again.
My God.
And I, at that point, I was like, oh, I am screwed. I mean, I was like so upset. I collapsed to my knees and I was like sobbing because I just knew what it meant at a core level. And I still kept going. I was like, well, I'm going to throw everything at this. I still have this dream, like assemble the team. Like I, you know, did all the PT work. I was in the pool every single day doing core, like doing everything possible to be as ready as I could be for those Olympic qualifying races. And I did put forth my best effort given circumstances. So unfortunately it wasn't enough for me to be selected, and I can like still sleep at night knowing that like I gave it my best. Yeah. Like I threw the kitchen sink at it. So from that like extremely devastating experience and like a major failure, I kept going. I was like, okay, I get to define my career. No one else does, like not the selection committee, no one else. And so I finished out the season and I had a ton of stuff go wrong. Like as soon as I was coming into form, finally, I got a concussion, like right before Worlds, didn't race Worlds. Then the next World Cup I could race, I literally like fell off a bridge. Like, and I fell on a stump. I got like an uppercut punch to my chin. God. It was all going south. And then like, it finally came together at the last World Cup of the season in West Virginia and snowshoe on home soil. And like, I finally had the race I knew I could. And I was the first American. And I rode most of that race with Yolanda Neff.
Yeah.
Like on my wheel. Like I was pulling her around until she dropped me on the last lap, which is like a classic Yolanda move. But like I finished that race and like I had a moment of, it was amazing. Like it was an amazing experience because at first American, the whole crowd was behind me. And I thought, oh, I just finished with the current Olympic champion drafting off of me for most of that race. And, you know, in that moment I thought, yeah, if circumstances had just been a little bit different, you know, just been a little bit different, it might have worked out differently for me. And, you know, still such a hard experience. And I have been excavating that whole year to launch my speaking career, essentially, because there are so many important, like human experiences about resilience and failure that it was such a human experience that I went through. And so I learned a ton and I speak about it to tell my story.
Yeah, I love that. And like I think I opened the podcast talking about having just watched your TED Talk, and I'll link to that as well because I thought that was a great story.
Thanks, Dave.
So I'm going to let you go pretty soon, but just a couple more questions for you. The first is the U.S. women are doing pretty fantastic right now. And so,
yes,
what do you think, like, what caused the switch to flip, and like, where do you hope that plays out over the course of the season? Let's start there.
Oh, it is so, it's been very, very exciting to watch these opening World Cups. We've been building towards this kind of like domination, I feel like, for a while. And the groundwork has been laid. I mean, I always said, like, this generation were like, they were U23s when I was racing at the top of my career in elite. And I was like, this is it. They're it. Like, I was like, there are five of them that could absolutely be at the top of the sport. And it's playing out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's like exactly like I thought, which is just amazing for each and every one of them, because they have worked so hard and for so many years and made it through each of them challenges of their own to get to this point. So it's just, it makes me emotional actually to see it working out for them, because I know each and every one of them like deserve it.
Yeah.
And what this does for USA Cycling is huge, because you can't see it. No, you can't be it if you can't see it. Right. Right? So, I mean, you could see it actually play out with Jen Jackson, the Canadian rider, at the last World Cup. She has put in her best World Cup results. And she literally says, because it's, I see all of these American riders up there, and I'm like, oh, this is like a US Cup. I can do this.
Yeah.
Right? Because she's ridden with all those riders and raced with them in a US Cup. So now all of a sudden she knows that she can ride at the front of a World Cup, because, oh, I can ride with them.
Yeah.
And so all it takes really is one person to do it. And then it starts, like, it's contagious.
Yeah.
And it also plays out in terms of teams. Like, so team opportunities, pro teams and support, they are few and far between, and they're very coveted spots. And so what we saw happening after Kate Courtney won Worlds in 2018 was all of a sudden all these European teams were like, oh my God, Kate won Worlds. Okay, I'm going to sign these American riders.
Mm.
And Kelsey Urban got on a team. Gwendolyn Gibson got on Trek Factory Racing. Sevilla got on a French team. I mean, they all got signed.
Yeah.
And so it's like a success builds on success in terms of that as well. And so it's just very exciting to watch.
Yeah. I as you talk about that, I think about Roger Bannister, who ran the first sub 4 minute mile or whatever. And it was the same, like, I read the book and it's like the same thing, where it's like, everybody's trying to do it around the same time. But as soon as one person does it right in a row, they're just like, do, 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 because it's just like breaking that mental barrier and like seeing, you know, like whatever, that last bit of confidence or whatever to push yourself. So that's super cool.
Yeah.
So what would be your advice to up and coming female racers, or just any female racer in general?
Keep going. I mean, it's really, if you develop resilience to, like, you will outlast a lot of your competitors. And how you develop resilience is, I have a saying, happiness is fast. And so you have to make sure that you're having fun and you're happy while, like, going through the grind of training. So, like, whether that's, like, you know, doing a destination ride to, like, an ice cream shop or, like, a coffee shop.
Yeah.
I mean, after every motor pace, well, most motor paces that I did with my coach, Andy, they would end at Palmer Lane, which is, like, our maple shop. And there would be maple creamies, which creamies is soft serve ice cream. And we would end with a creamy.
Now, like, I need one of those. Like,
yeah. I know, yum. And so, yeah, make sure you're enjoying it and, like, and keep going. Like, just keep working hard, because it will eventually pay off.
Fantastic. thank you so much for your time. I super appreciate this. I'm glad we made this happen. Where can people find you?
On Instagram, they can find me at Leah Eats a Lot.
I love that.
It will come up if you look up Leah Davison. I also have a website, and then check out the my TED Talk, and I also gave a moth style story that I will send the link to you.
Please do. Awesome. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.